from the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California. I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. Barney Hoskins is my guest this week. He's the author of many fine books on the history of popular music, including the classic, now happily back in print, Waiting for the Sun, Strange Days, Weird Scenes, and the Sound of Los Angeles. He's also the author of books on The Band, Haight Ashbury, Led Zeppelin, and in 2005, Barney Hoskins published Hotel California, The True Life Adventures of Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young, Mitchell, Taylor, Brown, Ronstadt, Geffen, The Eagles, and their many friends. Barney Hoskins is also the keeper of the website rocksbackpages.com, an online archive of rock and roll journalism. His new book is Low Side of the Road, A Life of Tom Waits. He joins us tonight from England. Barney Hoskins, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Nice to be talking to you.
Your new book is called Low Side of the Road, A Life of Tom Waits. You're continuing to be fascinated with American rock, with California rock.
It would seem so, although, you know, Tom Waits is a bit of an aberration in that setting. He's not the archetypal Southern California artist, or at least he offers an alternative experience, if you like, or an alternative view of the Southern California dream.
Well, what drew you to write about Waits?
Oh, I mean, I've really loved the guy and listened to him for years, and thought that there was scope for for a new book. I felt he hadn't been terribly well served by biographers, not least because he makes life difficult for people writing about him, but I thought it was time that somebody attempted not a warts and all account of his life, but just an account that dug a little deeper and cast the net a little wider and really attempted to speak with people who'd known and worked with him.
But your book isn't completely about Tom Waits. It seems like it's reaching for more. It's layered. It's what else are you fascinated with that you're talking about in the book?
Well, I mean, it's Waits. It is a number of things that are refracted through Waits' life and work. I mean, that's the primary purpose of the tome is to tell the story of his life and his music. Inevitably, you know, there are influences on him and people that he's influenced that one is writing about as well, and one is also, I suppose, you know, there is a sort of, you talk about layers, I mean, one layer is the very challenge of writing a book about Waits in the first place, and the nature of biography, especially when applied to such a reluctant subject, or an obtuse subject in many ways. So a thread, or maybe it's not a thread, but certainly something I confront at the very start of the book in the introduction is what a unique biographical proposition he is, because he tries to thwart anyone's attempts to write about his life, but he's also someone who questions the very nature of truth in any kind of biographical or autobiographical sense, and is someone who has played with a variety of masks or personae to kind of obscure himself. And so, you know, if you ask the real Tom Waits to stand up, I think you're on a hiding to nothing, or at least it's not a question that he would validate.
Well, is it? I mean, in a way, it's like the magician who saws the lady in half. You know that he's not really sawing her in half, but if you knew how it was done, then it wouldn't be amazing. So is that what Tom Waits is so reluctant to be exposed? He's holding on to his persona?
Look, at the end of the day, I think he's a very honest and unpretentious man, actually, the truth. But it's not so much that he doesn't want people to find out that, for example, he's the son of two middle-class school teachers from suburban Southern California. I don't think he'd really have an issue with that. It's more just the reductive nature of biography that he's suspicious of. I suspect when he knew I was embarking on this, that he thought I would just be another writer attempting to whittle down the facts of someone's life and try to explain an artist's work that way. Well, maybe that's what I am, you know, on some level. Yes, I'm trying to find out some of the facts of his life, but I'm not trying to explain away the nature of his work and the idiosyncrasies of his songs.
At the same time, you know, you do have a reputation, and you've interviewed Tom Waits. I know I've heard your interview on Rock's Back Pages, right?
Yeah.
So although you'd interviewed him in the past, he wasn't interested. He avoided you, and there's a big section in your book where people email you and tell you they're not going to speak with you, and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I had interviewed him on two or three occasions and gotten well with him, and I think a lot of writers have got on very well with him. I don't presume for a second that he remembered our interviews or knew my name or anything. I think it would be the height of arrogance to presume that. I mean, I tried knowing it was probably futile to interest him in being a part of it or coming on board in some way, or, you know, giving me some new interviews for the book. sent him stuff I'd done. The publisher sent him things, and I mean, we knew it would come to nothing, and it may ultimately have damaged us. But I certainly never personalized that. Took it as a rejection. I just thought I don't think anyone would have got his blessing, other than someone that he'd you know, specifically appointed to do a book with him. And I imagine that at some point he may do that, or more than likely he might write his own book, you know, his own sort of chronicles. But it'd certainly not be an orthodox autobiography, and Tom is not interested in orthodoxy. So he resists the conventional biography. And I mean, you know, at the end of the day, my biography is a conventional biography with some unconventional elements in it, and I hope a more personal approach, perhaps. But you know, it is an attempt to tell the story from the beginning to the present, and to try to get a better sense of where the guy's coming from and how his life has informed his work.
And your voice is slightly different in this book than in your previous books. Is that what you're referring to when you say it's a more personal narrative? I mean, you're kind of in the book more.
Well, I don't know whether I'm in. I mean, I don't think I'm in the book very much. But I take issue with any biographer and comes to any journalist who can say that they can remove themselves completely from a story. And it is the Heisenberg principle. You are affecting what you are writing about, and you cannot pretend to absolute impartiality, detachment, disinterestedness. You know, your own agenda is in there, and, you know, let's be frank about that.
Let me just pursue this a little bit more. If you're, you know, if you admire Tom Waits, and obviously you do, and he doesn't want you to write about him, then why persist in writing about him when there's so much else to write about?
Because you know, he's an interesting man who's done a lot of interesting work, and if you think, well, maybe I could write differently or even perhaps better about that life and work than has hitherto been done, then I think you do it, you know, and you don't apologize for it, you know. We have a right to publish biographies of famous people, so I'm not, you know, I don't write books to make friends or kind of not antagonize people. I write books that need to be written, and I felt that there was a new book about Bob Dylan every 6 months, and it just seemed crazy to me that there wasn't there weren't more books about Tom Waits, shall we put it like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Certainly not a book that has attempted to, you know, I mean, I did about 75 interviews for the book, to, despite their attempts to stop me talking to anyone. And I had a right to do that, and I felt I had some duty to do that. You know, there are a lot of Waits fans out there who want to read about him and know more about him. And I don't mean about what goes on behind closed doors and in the Waits homestead. It's not one's trying to sort of dig up dirt on the guy. There really isn't very much. But it is a fascinating life, and the way he's operated is very interesting, I think. You know, and there just weren't, you know, when we looked at, I talked with a publisher about doing a biography, and there just weren't very many other candidates that hadn't had, you know, a number of books written about them, in some cases very good books. You know, there wouldn't, to me, be much point in embarking on a biography of Neil Young after Jimmy McDonough's book. You know, I wouldn't really see the point of that. Some artists have kind of been done and done well. Waits has barely been done at all.
There hasn't been a book about the Beatles all day.
Well, there you go. You know, it's extraordinary to me that. I mean, I think Waits is a major artist, and he may not have sold as many records as Bob Dylan, but I think he will, in time to come, he will be recognized as kind of up there with the Dylans and the Youngs.
Well, we're talking with Barney Hoskins, and his new book is a biography of Tom Waits, and it's called Low Side of the Road. You've also written about actors. You wrote about Montgomery Clift and James Dean. But Tom Waits is kind of an actor. When I've seen him on stage, in the three or four times that I've seen him in concert, he's playing a role.
And yeah, I think that's absolutely right, and he would have been the first to admit that. You know, he said to me that all performance is an act of ventriloquism, he would say. You know, that if you just put yourself out there kind of nakedly, you know, then you're in trouble. You need to throw your voice, as it were. You need to create some distance between the character you are projecting and the real you. Whatever that is, you know. And what is the real you? Who can say for sure? Certainly in the lives of performers, but I think he felt that to some degree he was protecting himself, you know, when he played this sort of drunken, mumbling character at the piano, it was a form of self-protection. And today, maybe, you know, today it's a different character or characters that he projects, but it's still about, you know, protecting himself, hiding behind that and protecting himself.
He plays a sort of a damaged person.
In some ways, you know, he is the sort of patron saint of the dispossessed and marginalized, disenfranchised kind of underbelly Americans, I think. And he still has that role to some extent. He's not interested in mainstream, you know, status quo entertainment America. You know, he's interested in the weird stuff that occurs at the margins of society. I think to some degree he still writes about that, and that's what he's always hymned and lyricized.
You know, rock music is sort of a young man's game, generally. I mean, most of the artists that we've just been discussing, Neil Young, Bob Dylan, they did their best work, although they're all still working, but they did their best work in their 20s. What about Tom Waits?
No, I think Waits has had a very singular career, which you could say has had a career in two acts. You know, there is the 70s work, and then the startling reinvention, where he became something completely different, and something much more eclectic and experimental and dissonant and difficult in some ways. You know, he left behind one style of music and took on board an array of styles and approaches and influences, which, you know, has dominated the last, you know, almost 30 years of his career.
It's not music that gets played on the radio, certainly.
Not a lot. No. Not a lot. It's not radio friendly fodder. he has written the odd song that other artists have had hits with, obviously, you know, Downtown Train by Rod Stewart being the best example. So he's managed to have it both ways. He's made money through cover versions of his songs while retaining a certain, you know, element of singularity and credibility, whereby, you know, he cannot be accused of toadying to commercial pressures.
Well, actually, I think O-55 was recorded by the Eagles even before he had ever made a record. I'm not sure, but I think.
Not before he made a record, as it happens. It was done a year after it came out on his first album. The Eagles covered it. And I always think that that's probably a big break for Waits, because unlike some of his contemporaries, he had a song covered by a huge band, and that would have brought in some very useful money at a kind of key early stage when he might not have made it. You know, he might simply have been dropped by his record label, but, you know, that proved that you know, he was a songwriter. I mean, he's had his songs, many of his songs, covered by many, many artists, and, you know, I can only imagine that even, you know, we're talking micro payments, perhaps, but, you know, it all adds up. And I think he probably makes a very decent living. He's also made good money from suing people.
How has he sued? Why has he sued people? Oh, has somebody used a song? Well, why? Tell us.
He sued, famously sued Frito-Lay for using a Tom Waits sound alike in an ad for I can't remember what they were,
chips of some kind.
Yeah, chips of some kind, precisely. I can't remember what they were called now. And, you know, they just got in some guy to do a sort of pastiche of his of Step Right Up from his Small Change album. And he was absolutely furious about it because he'd taken such a stand against artists sort of prostituting themselves for capitalism. And he ended up, it took a while, but he ended up getting $2.5 million out of that lawsuit.
Hmm.
So it's handy money.
Who else has he sued?
I think he sued one or two other, you know, ad agencies who've done similar things or taken songs of his and had other people. Heart Attack and Vine by Screaming Jay Hawkins was used in a Levi's ad. He certainly went to town on that. I mean, it's incredible, given his litigious track record, it's incredible that companies still persist in doing this. That's almost been a second career for him.
We're talking with Barney Hoskins about his new book, Low Side of the Road, A Life of Tom Waits. Screaming Jay Hawkins is kind of an interesting person to mention because he also sort of plays a role. I mean, they kind of play a similar role, kind of a dangerous person.
I mean, I don't know whether Tom was that aware of or influenced by Screaming Jay Hawkins. He certainly had nothing against the guy. I think it was more about his old manager, Herb Cohen, who'd licensed the cover version of that track by Screaming Jay. But, I mean, vocally, you could imagine that Hawkins might have been an influence on Waits. You could certainly, I Put a Spell on You is a song that, you know, Waits loves, I think. I think you could imagine Waits covering that himself.
Yeah, yeah. It would be interesting to hear Waits do some covers. And you also point out in your book, and I don't know why I never saw it before, because I've only looked at it, you know, 10,000 times, but the album cover that's exactly like Wee Small Hours of the Morning by Frank Sinatra.
Yeah. I mean, that was just a moment of I literally had those two albums sort of side by side, and I suddenly saw that, consciously or unconsciously, the cover of The Heart of Saturday Night was an homage to the cover of In the Wee Small Hours of the Morning. And it may have been totally unconscious, but it was a striking moment of realization. So I just decided to juxtapose those two in one of the illustrations in the book. Yeah, so Sinatra, I mean, you know, one of the things that, I mean, I think to some extent we already knew this about Waits, but I go into it in a great deal more depth, just how out of step he felt with his own peers and his contemporaries as a child, as a teenager. You know, he didn't feel part of the, dull sort of rock and roll kind of explosion, and then the 60s, flower power, zeitgeist. You know, he felt very out of step with that. He was not interested in going to festivals and having Jimi Hendrix posters on his wall. He was more interested in the music of, his dad liked and his friend's dads liked, and he'd be more likely to, when he went around on play dates, he'd be more likely to end up sitting with his friend's dads listening to Sinatra albums and talking about that, So, and that's very clear in how he kind of really, as hard as Saturday Night Nighthawks at the Diner, he goes absolutely full tilt into this beatnik jazz area, which has just nothing to do, which is a complete rejection of the Southern California sound of the time. I mean, he pretty loathed James Taylor and in fact even the Eagles, and he was quite happy to bite the hand that fed him. I mean, even after the Eagles had covered Old 55 and made him some good money, he completely sneered at them and dismissed them. And even Neil Young, he kind of just rejected all these people who were on his own record label. And I think that's kind of commendable. I mean, you've got to admire the kind of audacity of that. I don't think it made David Geffen very happy. But, he was saying, look, I'm not interested in being part of what's going on in rock and roll. My heart lies in the 40s and 50s, and, I'm still living in Jack Kerouac's America.
But his singing style and as a performer would never have existed before Bob Dylan or Van Morrison or the people who kind of pioneered that sort of non-traditional way of singing.
No, I mean, I'm sure Dylan, I know Dylan was a huge influence on him, not obviously vocally, but just in the way Dylan positioned himself and the way Dylan mythologized himself and messed with the media's preconceptions of who he was. Vocally, it is an unnatural voice. It's a character that he's created in his voice, and it's a kind of mixture of Louis Armstrong and Captain Beefheart with maybe a bit of Dr. John in there.
A little Ken Nordine also.
In some instances, that's right, again, Wade said to me once, what, Bob Dylan isn't doing an act? There is this idea that there are certain artists who are giving you the essence of their soul, in some kind of unmediated way. And of course, it's nonsense. Bob Dylan's doing an act. Bob Dylan is a kind of character. And that's all Waits is really saying. He's just made it's just more exaggerated in Waits' work. But I think if you take the character of the voice on its own terms, it doesn't in any way take anything away from the emotion of the music.
It adds to it, if anything.
Well, just as an actor playing a part in a movie, it's not real, but it can move you to tears. It's no different. So the voice. I mean, the classic Waits voice that we know, the growling, gravelly voice, really began in earnest with Small Change. And Tom Traubert's Blues is probably his best and certainly his most famous song, first track on that album, 1976. One of his old muckers from that time, Paul Bodie, told me that when Waits came back from Europe in the late spring of 1976, his voice had changed. Something happened on that tour, and he was singing in this much more exaggerated kind of way, dredging up this voice from the sort of bowels of his being.
Wasted and wounded, it ain't what the moon did. God, would I pay? Can I borrow a couple of bucks from you to go still love you. Oh, waltzing Matilda with me. I'm an innocent victim of a blinded alley, and I'm tired of all these soldiers here. No one speaks English and everything's broken, and my stasis is soaking wet. I do go waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you go waltzing Matilda with me. Now the dogs are barking and the taxi cab's parking, a lot they can do. Shirt open, and I'm down on my knees tonight. Old Bushmills, I staggered. You buried the dagger, your silhouette window light. As you go waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda.
That is obviously the voice that we've gotten to know. I mean, it's not that there aren't other voices that he's used in different registers and timbres that he's employed, but that's the one we know best, and it's the one that there's a continuum from Tom Traubert's blues right up to the present day.
He hasn't really pursued a career as an actor, even though he is an actor and has appeared in films. Why do you think that is?
I think he got fed up with sitting around in trailers, having people, you know, fussing around him with makeup and hair and stuff. You know, he just came to the conclusion that life was too short to waste that amount of time. He said actors basically get paid for being bored. They get what they're really paid for is waiting. And he didn't have time to wait, you know. So he'll do little cameo roles now that just require him being there for a couple of days, you know, but he's not going to be sitting around in a trailer for weeks on end. He had a real stab at that, and he did a number of quite sizable movie roles over, I suppose, a 5-6 year period. But then he decided he just really wanted to be present for his kids' childhoods, and he was, and he really just opted out of mainstream Hollywood, and decided that wasn't what he wanted to do. However much money there was to be made doing it, it wasn't interesting to him.
Well, you've just been to Hollywood. How is your book being received in California?
I don't know, California. Well, I got a good review in the LA Times, which was nice. Early indications, as I say, would seem to suggest that the book is going down well in America. It's certainly gone down very well here in Europe, and I got a nice review in the New York Times, which is always gratifying. And, there's some people who are taking issue with me mentioning and sort of alluding at all to the fact that, the process of writing the book was fraught with obstacles and feel that I shouldn't be mentioning the fact that Waits and Kathleen asked people not to speak to me. But I thought long and hard about it, and I thought it was relevant. It was very relevant to the story. It was absolutely pertinent.
But it does seem an interesting subtext in your biography.
Well, look, I mean, you know, some people think it's petty to make it clear how what lengths they went to stop people talking to me. But I think it's important people understand or appreciate the perversity of trying to stop Keith Richards from saying how great you are.
Well, it's a fantastic book, and now that you've been on From the Bookshelf, I'm sure it'll shoot up the bestseller lists.
I'm counting on it, Gary.
Thanks for stopping by and talking about it.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be on your show again.
That's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I want to thank my guest, Barney Hoskins, author of the new book, Low Side of the Road, A Life of Tom Waits. I'll be back again next week with another From the Bookshelf. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. Check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. Thanks for listening, everybody. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night.